All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Thank you for joining me on this Saturday, May 12th, 2018. A little rainy out there, but should subside. You should have plenty of time to play golf. It's even not that bad right now. Going to fly solo today. Unfortunately, my sometimes co-host Steve had a recent death in the family, so thoughts and prayers to him and his family. He'll be back with us next week. Looking forward to today's show. Michael Clayton from OCCM Golf Design will be on the program today. Looking forward to that. That should be an interesting conversation. Always love talking a little golf course architecture. If you've been living in a little bit of a cave and you aren't paying attention to the championship, the PGA, I should say, the PGA Tour and the Players' Championship, Webb Simpson went super low last night or yesterday, 63 at minus 15, and then a host of trio of golfers, Charles Schwartzel, Patrick Cantlay, and Danny Lee, all at minus 10. And then it all gets bunched up after that. So it should be an interesting weekend. See what happens today. See how Webb Simpson, who's been out of the mix for a bit, how he holds up over on moving day, if you will. It should be an interesting Saturday round, if anything. See what happens and how this all shakes out by Sunday afternoon. Interesting course, as usual. So I could be interested to get Michael's thoughts on the Sawgrass, but we're going to take a short break and we'll be back. We'll be talking with Michael Clayton. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
The Long Island Golf Association is a nonprofit organization of 81 private and public clubs. The LIGA conducts 15 championships annually and works closely with the Long Island Caddy Scholarship Fund. The scholarships are granted to young men and women who are employed at member clubs. For more information on how you can participate in a championship, or if you'd like to donate your time as a volunteer, please call the LIGA at 516-746-1015. That's 516-746-1015. 1015, or visit us at www.longislandgolf.org.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit petesgolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Pleased to be joined on the line by golf course architect Michael Clayton and PGA professional. How you doing, Michael?
I'm good, Anthony. You?
Doing okay. Thanks for joining us this morning. I don't know what time it is over there, to be honest with you. I would think it's somewhat sometime in the evening, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 10 o'clock at night.
All right, okay. So we're at the opposite ends of the spectrum here. You're getting ready to go to bed, and I'm just getting my day going here.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. You guys are way behind us.
Want to start start with you, actually. I think that maybe if there's a few people, I think people are starting to get to know you. You've been very interactive on social media, but just for those who may not know you, or maybe some locals here that are listening, talk a little bit about your playing career. And then how you got started in golf course design?
Oh, well, I played in Australia, and I played the European Tour for about 15 years. I guess I played with Rick Hartman, who's a pro up there at Atlantic. I knew Rick pretty well, so we had some good times over there. So I played in Europe for a lot, and then a couple of superintendents in Melbourne, really, who were dabbling in golf course design in the mid-90s, and they asked me if I wanted to get involved with them and start a business up, so we did that. So it didn't seem that long ago, but I guess it was 23 years ago. Wow. So it's so we now have a business with Jeff Ogilvie. So four of us down here, Jeff, myself, Mike Cocking and Ashley Mead, who are all really Melbourne-based guys from the bottom end of Australia. So we're branching out of Australia a little bit at the moment. But it's been a lot of fun for us so far.
When you said a couple of superintendents came to you, was it a surprise to you? Was it something that you had been dabbling in or were thinking about? I mean, I feel like they didn't just pick you out of anywhere, but so how did you get into the mix there?
It came about, I knew one of them. It came about because I was writing for The Age, the newspaper. So Peter Thompson, the five-time Open champion from down here, had written for The Age for a long time. And I had a friend who... he got me writing on the Sunday paper, writing golf when I was playing in Europe. And I wrote I spoke about architecture a little bit, just from a point of interest, really. Nothing I ever thought about getting involved in. I was playing. And,
right.
You know, they kind of liked what I'd written, and I guess that was what led them to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in a sense, it was, it came about from writing, really.
What was that you were, what
and
was
you
it?
Can write it?
Oh, so go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry. There you go. There you go.
I was just going to say, what were the types of things you were writing about? What had attracted you to, what struck you as enough to want to write about it?
Well, I remember the first column I wrote, we were playing a tournament at Royal Melbourne, and I wrote about the turning pro, really, and starting traveling in Europe and playing around Australia, but in Europe especially, and discovering that the best golf courses you played competitively played in competition were the ones you played in amateur golf.
Mm-hmm.
And you were on the pro tour and you found very quickly that the pro tour were played on the road for a decent prize purse. So I'd grown up watching pro golf in Australia where the tournaments tended to go to the best courses in the country, but going overseas I found that wasn't the case. So that was really the first article I wrote. But the second one I wrote was about, we played a tournament at a resort course in Queensland, and it was being advertised as the most difficult course in Australia, and I was kind of pumping it up as being a big deal. And I remember writing that my last line was that the course may well prove to be the most difficult course in Australia, but fear would be fooled into thinking it was one of the greatest courses in the country. So something that you would never dare write as an architect, but I guess when you're a player, there's a little more freedom to be critical of the golf courses you're playing on. Although that, even that now has been beaten out of the players. They don't dare criticise golf courses, so everything tends to be great, and every architect's great, and everything. But I'd grown up reading Peter Thompson wrote it was amazing that he wasn't kind of heavily criticised for it in the paper, but Peter could write whatever he wanted to down here because he was so revered. But Jack Nicklaus had rebuilt the Australian Golf Club in Sydney for the wealthiest man in Australia, a guy called Kerry Packer, who was a member of the club, and he paid for it. He was sponsoring the Australian Open. And Thompson's headline in The Age on one of the days, I think it was the Monday after the tournament, the headline was Packer Money Wasted. He proceeded to spend 1,000 words on absolutely slaughtering the golf course, which was, for a guy who was in the architecture business, he didn't have much respect for the niceties of not criticising other architects. He just slaughtered this place. And the irony was about 40 years later, Jack came back and rebuilt the golf course because he himself didn't think it was much good, apparently. But anyway, it was an interesting... It was certainly a different time, but I'd grown up reading Peter when Peter Thompson was not afraid to be critical of anything and everything in the paper, and that was the way I thought golf journalists should write. So I tried to get down the same path myself, but occasionally it gets you into trouble, but I think in the end people respect you more if you tell the truth.
Yeah, I agree. And I would think, you somewhat, even though you didn't initially, obviously you played on the Australian Tour, as you said, and the European Tour, where you did have one victory. I think growing up in the Sand Belt, you couldn't have had a greater formative education in golf course architecture. And then, ironically, you go to the European Tour where you think it's going to be all great and pie in the sky, I guess, if you will. But then you realize you're playing on tracks that maybe or golf courses that are less than, let's say, historically revered in terms of golf course architecture. But you certainly got the education of it with traveling the world, that's for sure.
Yeah, which wasn't to say we didn't play, I don't want to give the impression we only played bad courses in Europe.
Yeah, no,
we played
no.
Lots of really good courses.
Sure.
We played Sandal and Walton Heath and Chantilly in Paris, which is where they should be playing the Ryder Cup this year.
Right.
There were some tremendous courses in Europe, but, the tour, as I said, it would also go to some courses. I mean, it was the Swiss Open then, now the European Masters at Cronstadt. Yeah, I mean, it was a dreadful golf course, really, and still is, but it was a nice weekend. It was a beautiful place to play, but it wasn't a very good golf course. But, yeah, growing up in Melbourne was an amazing education and something that you almost take for granted that, we all first went down and watched tournaments at Royal Melbourne. I watched my first tournament there was the World Cup in 1972 when Tom Weisskopf played with Jim Jamison. That was the American team. And, you know, you sort of walk around that golf course and you know, I guess you know it's great because people tell you it's great. But when you really first start playing it and start figuring out how to play that golf course properly and how subtle it is and how clever it is and yet how wide it is, and, you know, it's not a place relying on long grass to penalize you. But if you go to the wrong side of the hole, you can't get near the flag because the greens are too hard and too fast and the angle's too bad, unless you hit a great shot, which I think was the great thing about Royal Melbourne, was that you could be out of position, but if you hit a great shot, you could get it back in place and back near the hole. But if you missed that shot, then you were really in big trouble. So it was always a course that was tempting you and tantalising you, but you really had to be clever to play it well. And I like the old course at St Andrews. There were lots of ways to play. It didn't really just favour one type of player. It favoured, you know, the player who thought about what he was doing, but, you know, there were lots of shots you could play to get near the hole. It wasn't just a sort of, you know, a big bomber's course, or it was, you know, there were lots of different ways to negotiate those questions that Mackenzie posed all the way back in the mid-1920s. And then Kingston Heath was just up the road. Victoria was right next door. Metropolitan, when I remember, is sort of 6 or 7 miles further north of Royal Melbourne. So there was a whole bunch of great courses that we all grew up playing as kids, and it was there have always been a lot of good players that have come out of that city.
When you think about where you started, and you said, as you said, you can't believe it's almost 25 years now. At what point were you? Was it a project? Was there a moment? Was there a was there an aha moment where, when you were doing this, when you started it, whether it was before OCCM or during OCM, that you were like, that you realized that this is really something that you love to do?
Well, no, it actually wasn't. I mean, I was always interested in it. I'd read a lot of books about it. You know, I'd kind of thought about the sandbar a lot. So whilst I'd never thought about going into the business, I knew I always enjoyed it. And from pretty much the first job we got was the Victoria Golf Club, where Peter Thompson had grown up as a teenager. Jeff Ogilvie had carried across the road at Royal Melbourne and then joined Victoria as a 16-year-old. So, you know, it was a terrific course. And the first job we ever had was really a maintenance job. The course was in bad shape, and my two partners really called in to try and get the course back into decent shape. But we found an old photograph of the course in the 1930s, early 30s. It was clear how much of it had been lost, how much of the bunkering had been rounded off and lost, and how they'd really planted trees in it's a common mistake to plant the wrong trees in the wrong places, certainly in Australia.
Right.
And, you know, so from the very first job we had, we were working on a great and historic course in Melbourne. And, you know, it was a lot of fun learning from Bruce Grant, who was one of my partners, about, you know, how to construct great-looking bunkers and how to go about making construction work. And, there are things that most people, and certainly most golfers, don't think about, but there's a whole lot of stuff under the ground that makes a golf course work that golfers never see or think about, that the irrigation and the drainage and the construction, all that stuff that's kind of nuts and bolts stuff that really makes it work. And so, going back to your question, it was great fun to work at a place like that. And, you know, as we went on, we sort of spread out around Australia and got to work at some of the best courses in Australia. So it was always interesting to me to go back to courses I'd played as a kid, courses I'd played tournaments on, courses that I held in high regard all around the country, and in fact go and work on them. But the course I won the Australian Amateur in 1978 at Royal Queensland, where Greg Norman was the assistant pro just before he started out on the tour, and they basically had to build a new golf course. There was a bridge that went over the golf course, and they lost six holes at the far end of the course. So they finished up building a brand new course. So that was a pretty cool job to get involved with. Given my history at that place, it was a lot of fun to do that.
My guest is Michael Clayton from OCCM Golf Design. I want to get back to sort of the changes in golf course architecture, but let me get to my first break here. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Golf course superintendents are the unsung heroes of our great game. Due to the game's efforts, we now have turf that needs less water, courses that are more sustainable, with many now offering natural wildlife habitats. From the days of old Tom Morris, golf course superintendents have given golfers a reason to love this great game. But don't take my word for it. Jack Nicklaus agrees.
If you love golf like I do, thank a golf course superintendent.
A message from the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America and local superintendents everywhere.
Owning the latest and greatest golf equipment makes no difference if it's not fit perfectly for your game. At Mizuno, we create irons and woods for all skill-level golfers, from our MP18 family, featuring three different models designed for the better player, to our JPX family, featuring three different models designed to give you distance and forgiveness. We have a model for everybody. Visit Pete's Golf Shop and get custom fit for a set of Mizunos today.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. My guest today is Michael Clayton from OCCM Golf Design with Jeff Ogilvy, Michael Cocking, and Ashley Mead. Michael, if you look at, we obviously know about the golden age or some classical age, if you will, of golf course architecture, and we look at today as some sort of rebirth of maybe like, or if you want to start with the opening or breaking ground of Bandon or something, to give some sort of line of demarcation as a sort of rebirth. What was the time in between? Was it a dark ages for golf course architecture? Or, I mean, not to say that there wasn't some good golf being, but it seems if we're having an awakening or a reawakening or a rebirth, something had seemed to have changed in the middle there.
Yeah, well, I guess the golden age finished really with the Depression, and then the Second World War came along, and that was the business was dominated by Robert Trent Jones and Dick Wilson in America. There were almost no golf course. There weren't any golf course architects working in Australia. The two guys that built golf courses in Australia primarily were both golf course superintendents. I'm not quite sure what happened in Europe, but yeah, it seemed like it was an era dominated by American and I know certainly in Australia that everything American was great. Was how people in Australia viewed golf in America. We're in awe of, the players over there, the golf course. We watched the CBS Golf Cast get Firestone, and Golf Digest would come out, and Firestone would be in the top 15 courses in the country. And that was what we thought American golf was, and that was what we thought was great about American golf. Whereas, and if you looked at the same list, the National Golf Links was probably rated below Firestone, which is, looking back, is pretty unbelievable. So, I mean, that might be the best golf course in the world. I mean, up where you are,
right?
That's one of the most amazing golf courses, I think, in the world. Incredible.
Yeah.
So certainly the perception of what was good changed. One of the first golf digests I saw was America's most 100 difficult golf courses. I mean, why you would ever do that list? But because that would rule out Cypress Point and a whole bunch of great courses that weren't particularly difficult to play but were great pieces of design. So, I think that Sandhills was an incredibly important course.
Right.
Course in Nebraska, Bill Kornbank, Grantshire, an amazing place.
Sure.
I think Mike Kaiser was a founder member there. And I suspect that was the place that inspired him to go and do Bandon. I know that if Bandon hadn't happened, Bunbury Dunes in Tasmania never would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So out of Sandhills came Bandon, I think, and Kaiser's passion to go and build golf like that, Cabot Links, Sand Valley, Castle Stewart, Galanta's great course near Inverness, Bunbury here, Cape Wickham down here, which Mike DeVries did on King Island. So there's been a whole bunch of great new stuff that's all come out of Sandhills and that amazing thing that Bill Coe and Ben Crenshaw did. And they were the guys who I think, if anyone led them, well, they certainly led the game in a different direction. And looking at their work, I mean, Fries has another great course up where you are. Looking at that beautiful work, you can see that those guys have a reverence for the old sort of style of work. You can see Royal Melbourne in those courses and Sunningdale and Morfontaine in Paris and the Valley Club out in California. You can see that sort of style and feel and look and philosophy about how the game should be played. And it wasn't just about long, narrow, penal, difficult golf courses sort of smothered in long green grass, but it was more about giving players space to play and lots of short grass. And what amazes me always is people talk about the Augusta effect in America and how America is sort of enamored with the look and feel of Augusta, yet one of the few courses that certainly the Pro Tour goes to where it's a celebration of short grass around the greens and big wide fairways, and in a sense you can almost, it's one of those courses where, not so much now because it's tighter than it was, but it's almost a course where you can drive the ball anywhere. A bit like Fernandez and Maldonado, you can drive it anywhere, but you can't play the golf effectively. You can't play the golf course effectively from anywhere. You've got to drive the ball well to play the golf course properly, but driving it well doesn't necessarily mean just driving it straight. It means getting in the right shape to the right parts of the golf course. So, you know, going back to the question again, Colin Crenshaw and Doak and Johansson, the guys who are doing the great stuff now, you know, they've gone back to celebrating width and space and not making golf a straight driving contest, which is something that, you know, that was why I always enjoyed playing the game, because that was the way Royal Melbourne was set up. You know, it was never about straight driving, but it was about accurate driving to a particular part of the fairway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you, it's amazing to me how the game sort of, you know, you mentioned the professional game and how, you know, penal and difficulty and all that, and how, I don't know, it sort of perverted the amateur game or what golf is to the majority of us. And it's a shame how that sort of happened, because obviously the pro game is not what we should be measuring ourselves against. If you want to be a professional amateur, that's fine. But the majority of us are people who are looking to play golf and have fun and be competitive. But it's not. It's meant to be wide open and have space and not, you know, U.S. Open style, golf courses.
Yeah, you know, so much of it goes back to probably 1951 at Oakland Hills and Hogan and Trent Jones and their kind of, you know, what did Hogan say? If your husband had to play his own golf course for a living, he'd be looking for a new line of work. I think it was what Hogan said to Trent Jones' wife or something like that. But, you know, and then kind of Hogan emerged out of that you know, he was a master of that style of golf, although Hogan could have mastered any style of golf clearly, but you know, he in particular mastered that brutal US Open straight driving, hitting green after green when no one else could, and that became he was such a revered figure in America that became the, you know, the type of golf that the US Open sort of became known for, and you know, I think many people saw that as that's how you find a champion. But you know, the irony of the I've always thought of the major championships was that the British Open or the Open Championship and the Masters always did a slightly better job of consistently finding the best players in the world. And they were two championships where, I mean, playing the wind and the weather was the test of the links, really. It was never about narrow fairways and long grass. Well, it was occasionally at Muirfield in 66 when Nicklaus won and when Greg won it. I played that Open at Turnberry. That was a brutally difficult narrow course, you know, with thick rough. That was an amazingly difficult Open. But generally, the Open and the Masters were great at finding the best players in the world, and they didn't do that by having 30-yard wide fairways bordered with long grass. In fact, the opposite.
Yeah, I agree. We only have this. I can't believe how fast this half hour goes. We only have a couple minutes here, maybe two. I'm just curious, and I would like to invite you, if you don't mind, to maybe we can continue this conversation on a podcast if you're interested.
Sure. Because podcast would be great. Yeah,
that would be fantastic, because I'd like to sort of pull on a few of those threads that you've talked about. But I'm just curious what you're excited most about OCCM going into the future.
Well, we've just rebuilt. Speaking of Ben Hogan. We've just rebuilt the little nine at Shady Oaks where he made famous by the tree up by the 18th tee there on the big course where he used to practice. So we've just finished off building that course. Mark Cocking ran that job for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start, they're closing the big course in August of 2019. So we get to rebuild Shady Oaks. So that's going to be a really cool job for us. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's an old Trent Jones kind of late 50s golf course that you know, I think we can do something with that. So, you know, that's an incredibly exciting job for us.
Sure.
We've just finished up rebuilding a golf course in Shanghai, which has been good for in China, which has been fun. We're finishing up a big 36-hole rebuild in Melbourne. There was an old club that I used to play a lot of golf at, Kingswood,
mm-hmm.
which is just down the road from Kingston Heath. It was sold for housing. They sold it for $100 million, and they merged with Peninsula, which is a club that we've been working at for a long time. And so we've just finished up a massive rebuild of Peninsula. And we go from there to a little beachside course called Point Lonsdale, which is close to an old golf course, Parliament Heads, which is an old famous, really the first links course built in Australia. So we've got a bunch of exciting work coming up. But for you people on that side of the Atlantic or the Pacific, Shady Oaks is going to be a great fun job for us. We're really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the. I've seen the concepts obviously on your website, so I'm looking forward to seeing more of that. And just as a little tease to those who are going to tune into the podcast, Michael and I are going to be talking a little bit about how golf today is a little bit like McDonald's. So just a little teaser there if you'd like to find out what we mean by that. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll get in touch real quick about the doing the podcast so we can sort of extrapolate some of the thoughts we kind of touched upon today.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, that was Michael Clayton.
Thanks,
take care. That was Michael Clayton from OCCM Golf Design, Golf Course Design. So I'm looking forward to talking more with him on the On Par podcast. That's it, folks, for today. Thank you for joining me. Hope we got you thinking a little bit about the game of golf and golf course architecture. We'll be back next week. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.